the Ulysses, man's greatest achievement. A ship capable of traveling to distant galaxies. But a freak accident leaves the ship helpless. Its AI, damaged, dangerous, plays a deadly game with the two surviving members of the crew. If they indulge the machine's newfound passion for science fiction and fantasy trivia, it will permit limited access to the astrogation matrix and star drive. For astronauts Clive Ashenden and Rob Wickens, the choice is clear. If they ever want to see Earth again, they must define the A to Z of SFF.
A is for Aeon Flux TV animation series. Continue.
Yeah, this is a good pick. I like this pick. Big fan of Aeon Flux, which it's one of those that it's got a real odd feel to it. It's very much one that's that has its own very clear identity, don't you think?
Yeah, I've seen it kind of described as avant-garde sci-fi animation, and it's not. I think that's putting it a bit too strongly, but it's a very weird mix of stuff. Certainly, I mean, we should say this kind of premiered on MTV's Liquid Television in 1991, which was like a sort of compendium of different animations, which part, you know, I guess the most what kind of well known of which is kind of Aeon Flux and Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, definitely. It was an interesting way of getting some more experimental stuff out there. You know, a bit more animation of a bit more of a kind of, in some cases, very rough and ready, like Beavis and Butthead, very rough and ready style. But then you had the Aeon Flux that was very, very polished in its way, but just deeply surreal. You know, it was taking cues from, I'd certainly say, a lot of French science fiction and, you know, illustrators like Jean Girard, Mobius and people like that. But, yeah, not the sort of thing that you'd kind of expect MTV to be doing.
Not really, and especially as it's very clearly an adult animation. You know, I mean, this contains, you know, well, sex and ultra violence,
extreme violence, yeah,
extreme ultra violence, and it's yeah, I mean, just in its initial form, it was just strange, I think, as well. But probably we should just talk about what it's about, if, as much as we can, because the initial couple of seasons, it starts as this sort of six-part serial of shorts, and then in 1992 you get five more shorts before you finally get a standalone season of half-hour episodes. And in those initial shorts, there's no dialogue at all.
No, absolutely not.
All you hear is kind of grunts, cries of pain, and even when there's like a sort of a news report, it's just sort of people burbling and literally that's what you hear. It's just, I mean, the sound design is really good, but it's almost like a weird silent movie, but it's like a silent movie version of a 2000 AD comic strip or something.
Yeah, absolutely. The silent movie thing is kind of apposite as well, because it's, yeah, they're very much kind of squibs. They're all that, I mean, we were sort of talking about sort of sex and violence, but there's an awful lot of weird physical comedy going on in there as well. And yeah, the sense of it, almost like the Buster Keaton sense of wild stunt work, where anything can and frequently will go desperately wrong at any given moment.
Yeah, there's a real mischievousness about it. I mean, we should say, like, Aeon Flux herself is this tall, leather-clad assassin-stroke-agent from the nation of Monica, but we don't really pick that up, at least in those initial seasons, because we don't hear anyone's, there's no voiceover, there's no real guide. We see some sort of news reports, we see different uniforms, you know, and so she's she's the kind of only recurring character except for sort of Trevor Goodchild, who's her nemesis stroke lover.
Yeah. And that kind of just sort of ties into the whole dynamic of the thing as well, because it's deeply kinky as well, I think. It's
yes. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, when you say Aeon Flux is leather clad, what you basically mean is she's clad in kind of sort of strips of leather, I guess, mostly with high kinky boots. But you know, that's about it.
That is about it. It's almost like her uniform, you know, which again, I guess, comes back to another different fetish. But you can't get away from the kind of subversive playfulness that sort of is throughout. I think it's more prevalent in the initial ones rather than in the longer form bits, which tend to sort of play out a bit more normally. But then those go off in their own surreal directions. So you get this sort of submission, sort of various sort of fetishes, and because of the way it's drawn, I've seen like Egon Schiele sort of mentioned an influence we should say this is created by Peter Chung, who's a Korean American who was a Korean American animator. He'd worked, and this was kind of where he finds his signature style, really. I mean, he worked in things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the animated series, and Rugrats before this. But then Aeon Flux becomes his signature piece, and then he goes on to sort of direct like stuff like one of the shorts in the Animatrix.
Mm.
But you know, he has this kind of, it's this like almost grotesque style.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a well-known term in animation called squeeze and stretch, which is to do with the way action is portrayed on screen. So, you know, animated characters can move in a very, very different way to real life counterparts. So they do sort of move in a slightly more rubbery way, if you like. And because of the way all the characters in Aeon Flux are drawn, they're drawn, as you say, very much in this sort of Egon Schiele kind of elongated and quite emaciated kind of a style, really. They do move in ways that don't actually look, well, they don't look right, but they look right for the setting, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting because the other sort of main subversive thing, apart from this sort of sex, which for American television, or it's not network television at that time, does seem quite, you know, risky or risque, I want to say.
Well, for a cartoon, definitely. Yeah. So
but I guess the other thing is the fact that in those initial shorts, Aeon Flux dies in every single one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I love the fact that there's no real sense of there being a sort of an overarching story at all. It's just like, she's supposed to be, you know, she's the heroine, and completely fails every time she tries to do something or accomplish a mission.
Yeah, and so again, it's part of this sort of it's kind of subverting your expectations. The other thing with it being sort of silent in those initial ones is that no one's going, this is the hero, this is the villain. So you see things like in that sort of initial season where she's gunning down like these sort of masked troops, and then rather than follow her on, we stay with the masked troops as one of them is sort of trying to help the other one as they're dying to get some last bit of comfort, and you actually find yourself feeling sorry for them. So they're allowed these sort of weird moments, whereas she's just sort of seems to have very little humanity. So it's kind of interesting because she's clearly supposed to be the heroine. I mean, we've also got to mention the iconic image, which is the one that sort of starts all the, which starts that sort of very first Aeon Flux pilot, which is the eyelash and the fly.
Mm. Which kind of tells you an awful lot about the fact that maybe Eon Flux isn't really that human at all. The fact she's got these incredible superhuman reflexes that she's able to catch a fly in her eyelash is, I mean, okay, I know it's animation, but at the same time, it does give you a very clear indication of the sort of, it's,
yeah, she's been, been augmented, perhaps. You know, I mean, I did think when I was watching them, you know, well, and especially, you know, now in the future when we have clones, you know, that she could, you know, is she just being cloned each time? You know, is it like she fails at a mission, so then they pop out another like Eon Flux version 7 or whatever, and she comes out and dies again, you know.
Just drag another one out of the wardrobe and send her off. But I mean, that initial image as well also sort of ties into the notion of you know, the Venus flytrap closing on a fly as well, and it makes it very clear that Eon is actually, you know, she's a predator. She is kind of pretty much the monster of the piece all the way through. So, you know, maybe we should be celebrating the fact that at least in the beginning she completely fails at what she's supposed to be doing, because, you know, she is the bad guy.
At least initially, I think. Well, let's call her the anti-hero, I think. It's maybe a better way of putting it. I mean, and then you get, and there are even like episodes like, I think there's one called War, where she basically, you know, it's like a 5-minute short, but she dies within, I think, the first 30 seconds. So then the rest of it is just you're following like a string of different people from different sides. And just as you get invested in them, they die. And then then they pick up with another person. It's almost like people have their own lives and care things that they care about. But, you know, in war is hell, folks. So that's kind of an interesting one to look at. But then, as I say, you get that third season of standalone ones where Eon Flux speaks, and she has the voice of Denise Poirier. And Trevor Goodchild is voiced by John Rafter Lee, you know, both kind of seasoned animation voices. And it's kind of, it becomes, I think then it does become a tiny bit more, you know, sort of interested in continuity and setting up this kind of, you know, police state. Which ends up, well, at the end of the first episode, there's a coup and Trevor Goodchild takes over as the sort of de facto
ruler,
dictator. But, you know, he's a strange, well, he's a perverse character, is perhaps the best way to put it, because apart from his, you know, strange sexual obsessions, he's also a scientist who seems to be trying to sort of, he has these weird kind of eugenics ideas about bettering humanity, and has no qualms about sort of killing people or you know, ethics about any kind of experiments that he might go into. You get this longer episode, so you get a bit more of Eon's kind of, I guess she becomes a bit more of a sort of standard kind of,
hero type character,
you know, because she's fighting the man, but still, even though they are supposed to follow this sort of continuity, the episodes do feel very standalone. And some of them, they just suddenly, you know, oh look, we've got aliens in this one. Oh, in this one, they've created. There's been some kind of god that's been created, and we're not really sure why. And you know, just and even to the very end one, last episode called End Sinister, which takes place over thousands and thousands of years, and has aliens and weird stuff and time travel and all kinds of crazy ideas. So there's a sense of kind of playfulness and like, we're going to throw stuff at a wall.
Yeah, definitely. So even though they've kind of gone for a slightly more generic kind of half hour slot with proper dialogue and some stab at characterization, they're still not afraid of just being wildly experimental. And again, you've still got that weird sense of perverse sex and unpleasant violence and this weird kind of screwball comedy thing going on all the way through it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And also you get this, there are weird sort of bits of Eastern mysticism sort of thrown in there. And or even just in her name, an eon is this notion from kind of Gnosticism. You know, this idea of a syzygy, a sexually complementary pair of emanations, which apparently was this why she's you know refers to her and Trevor, and yeah, it's deeply ambiguous as to how as to what if any feelings Eon has for Trevor. I mean, she's very kind of if she wants sex, she has it with whoever, and that mm-hmm. you know male or female, and so in that sense it's both progressive, but also I mean with all this kind of with all its fetish and S&M and kind of you know playfulness, I there is a bit of a slightly you know seedy exploitation edge, you know, that sort of that same bit that same thing that you get in you know certain anime as well, so you can't deny that. I mean it's like that, oh you know, empowered female character, but what, because she has a gun, you know, she spends a lot of the time undressed or in semi, it's a semi-dress, but to be fair, she does have her own agency throughout, and you know she chooses what she wears, but then you could say, well, her male creators choose what she wears, but yeah, so you know there are some troublesome elements to it, but you know I think it's a product of its time.
Yeah, I think it very much delights in that sense of the perverse and the grotesque and the transgressive, but at the same time, for that level of weirdness to go into a show that was shown on MTV in the early 90s as a, you know, as animation is pretty forward looking, really.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. And it's certainly kind of caught people's attention to the point where we actually got a feature film adaptation.
We did, yes. But maybe that's something we can talk about another time.
Maybe. Cyclomedia, how does that strike your fancy?
Input satisfactory.
Excellent. Okay, well, let's strap ourselves into our tight leather flight suits then, Clive, and point ourselves at that funny-looking star that looks something like a Venus flytrap closing on a hapless fly, shall we?
That sounds good, although I'm not sure about these new suits you've designed, Rob. Can I get one that covers more than my nipples?
No.
All right. Okay, 3, 2, 1, hit it.
A to Z of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden. The show was produced and edited by Rob Wickings at All Hallows Post of Reading, the finest sound available anywhere. Would you like to know more? Go to www.theatozofsff.com. Like us on Facebook as the A to Z of SFF. Or follow us on Twitter at the A to Z of SFF.